for July 3rd, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm Patriot Chip Hessenflo.
And I'm Canadian Pam Bedore.
You can still celebrate along with us, Pam, because you are currently in the United States. Happy 3rd of July, which is the celebration of everybody doing the fireworks a day early and all the dogs complaining about it.
I'm green card holder Pam Bedore.
And we want to remind all the little children out there to make sure you leave out milk and cookies tonight for Captain America.
A ritual of independence.
So we're here to discuss chapter 12 of The Sign of Four, the final chapter, the last chapter, the wrap-up of this action-adventure romance story.
Isn't this Indiana Jones and the Sign of Four, Steve?
That's what they'll rename it and ruin my childhood, yes. Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. Yeah, come on now.
It's got all the tropes in there, Steve. It's got all the tropes. Mm-hmm. There's love, romance, action.
That's it. Those are the tropes.
And drug use, Steve. And drug use.
Yeah. Don't forget about that at the end. We'll get to the ending. Oh, boy, will we get to the ending. We need to learn more about the history of India, Chip. We need to study up on our history of India. This is definitely a blind spot in our knowledge of history.
And, well, the United States, we tend to miss a lot of Eastern history. So China, Japanese history, and Indian history, and Australian history. You know, there's only so much time in school. It's a good time to pull out a book and learn a little bit about a country that, an area that we don't get to in school. We usually start our world history, I don't know, if you get like the moment where they go, and there was Egypt, and maybe before that there was Sumeria or Mesopotamia or something. Mm-hmm. And then we immediately start in with maybe the Greeks.
Right. We should do that. We should make that a summer project, getting to know India better. And, of course, attorneys can be your friends.
Yeah, something that Jonathan Small didn't realize, that he actually could, you know, hire a counselor, potentially, if he had maybe a ruby or two left, to try to protect his interests. He seems to be giving everything away, Steve and Pam.
It's the last chapter. There's no more knowledge to be had. It's time to spill your beans, Jonathan.
I don't know if that's really how when an attorney would advise a client in this type of situation, but let's go with it because Doyle's going to bring it to the table.
There you go. Chapter 11, we opened the box and there was no treasure and everything was all resolved in chapter 11. Chapter 12 starts, there's a treasure!
Was it love, Steve? Was it love?
You know, guys, I thought the opening of chapter 12 was super interesting because, of course, we end with Watson and Mary finding each other their own treasure. Then, a very patient man was that inspector in the cab, reminding us that this cop has been waiting the whole time. For it was a weary time before I rejoined him. His face clouded over when I showed him the empty box. There goes the reward, he said gloomily. Where there is no money, there is no pay. This night's work would have been worth a tenner each to Sam Brown and me if the treasure had been there. Now, did that strike you guys as odd? Because this is a police officer.
It did strike me as odd. It does. To say that there is no pay for this work without the treasure, is that valid?
So as an attorney, would you say there is an incentive for the police officers to make sure there is a treasure? My goodness, this seems like it's, it seems very odd that the police officers would get part of the whatever is found or whatever is captured.
Right. So it's really interesting because, of course, they shouldn't. But this was a huge concern in the 19th century. Now, again, I've studied the American side far more than the British, so I'm just guessing. But in the New York Times, in the 19th century New York Times, there were many, many articles about concerns with police corruption, with police actually taking part of the spoils, not handing over all of the money when they captured criminals of various kinds. And so I kind of wondered as I was reading this, I was like, wow, Doyle is kind of making it sound like that issue of corruption is, you know, equally present in the British force, which would make a lot of sense in this period. So, and don't forget, you know, we only really start having a police force in 1850, 1855. So we're only 30, 35 years into, you know, people are not used to having an official police force. So there's a lot of anxiety about the unknown. I don't know what the stats are around police corruption. In the US, they weren't horrible. The anxieties were far higher than the statistical evidence for those anxieties. But I just wanted to point that out. It's kind of an interesting moment.
So do you think that that's Doyle saying that these men were waiting for the treasure and they were planning to take a piece of it? Or do you think he was saying that that's how they get paid and there will be no pay for this night's work?
There will be pay. Like, these are police. He's an inspector. So I don't know. It's an odd moment. Yeah.
It's a pretty offhand comment on that structure. It didn't strike me when we got to that. I also felt
like, Athelney Jones sent that police inspector with Watson to keep an eye on the damn box, right? So, like, I felt like he didn't really do his job to be like, okay, I'll just wait here in the cab. You take it in and show your girl, then bring it back. Like, that wasn't that guy's job. But, right. Of course, you know, Watson wouldn't have made his proposal and had such a wonderful moment with Mary in her diaphanous white dress with the police officer there. So there's a plotting issue here, too.
And as that, it was empty. You mean that lock box that was so heavy is empty?
Exactly. Exactly.
I did think of that as well.
Yeah. And what an amazing ring you have for
pretty
Mary.
Pretty sketchy. Yeah.
Is that a ruby and a diamond?
A barrel and a coronet. So what did happen to the treasure? Jonathan Small says, yes, I have put it away where you shall never lay hand upon it. He cried exultantly, it is my treasure, and if I can't have the loot, I'll take darned good care that no one else does. He scattered it up and down the Thames, is what he says.
So this is quite a moment here. And then Athelney tells Jonathan Small he would have had a better chance at justice if he'd been able to hand over the treasure. He's like, you're an idiot. Justice, snarled the ex-convict. A pretty justice. Whose loot is this if it is not ours? Where is the justice that I should give it up to those who have never earned it? Small had dropped his mask of stoicism, and all this came out in a wild whirl of words while his eyes blazed and the handcuffs clanked together with the impassioned movements of his hands. You forget that we know nothing of all this, said Holmes quietly. We have not heard your story, and we cannot tell how far justice may originally have been on your side. It's kind of an interesting moment because Small gets really, really indignant. And I kind of love that alliteration, a wild whirl of words. It's hard to say, but kind of poetic.
Not to mention the clanking handcuffs with the impassioned movement of his hands. That's beautiful.
Yeah. And then Holmes is really calm and he's like, hey, buddy, we actually don't know what you're talking about. So, like, tell us where this justice comes from. And let me pause and ask you guys, do you think that Jonathan Small earned this treasure in a just way? He killed someone for it. Is that justice?
And it's the spoils of war, and he was involved with basically taking it from the other side in this war. I don't know that that is... I'm pretty sure that's ill-gotten gains at this point.
Totally.
And that's exactly where it's coming from. This was... they shot someone, they killed someone.
I cast my firelock between his legs as he raced past, and he rolled twice over like a shot rabbit. Ere he could stagger to his feet, the Sikh was upon him and buried his knife twice to his side. Right, yeah, so he's an accessory.
Yeah. Interesting.
So then they bury him-ish.
Right. Yeah.
With the treasure, knowing they're going to have to come back to it, because it's not like they can run around with this treasure on their body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So, Steve, you know, on a day off, it's, you know, it's hot out there, you're in India, let's go for a swim.
Yeah, his second mistake is to go swimming in the Ganges River where a crocodile took his leg. So now we know the reason why he has a wooden peg leg.
Just like Peter Pan. Yeah.
Totally was what I was thinking. And you know, it's interesting because the Peter Pan reference, of course, Peter Pan's written after this, right? I'm not saying, you know, that it's a reference, but that crocodile that Captain Hook is so afraid of has a clock inside, right? So like that crocodile represents mortality. So it's kind of it's an awesome symbol, but it actually follows this one in time. So Doyle's not referencing it.
We get here the history of the Indian Rebellion of 1857 and a whole cast of characters in Chapter 12. I was so happy that Chapter 12 was not a major info dump. This is a good action adventure chapter with a whole slew of characters going through this whole action.
This could be a prequel, Steve, if maybe George Lucas could put it together for us.
Pam, do you know of any fan fiction that is written about this story? This is one of the more popular books, right?
It is a very popular novel, and for good reason, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's a great question. I haven't taught any pastiches that specifically reference Sign of Four, although I feel like there should be now that we're rereading it.
I feel like there probably is. And
I'm sure there are, yeah.
I'm sure there's some very creative people who have filled in even more of the holes in this story and created even better action-adventure stories with this cast of characters.
Well, I keep referencing Indiana Jones. This book is an Indiana Jones film.
Totally. Completely. We get to the box of treasure. When the young men in this story opened it, the light of the lantern gleamed upon a collection of gems such as I have read of and thought about when I was a little lad in Penshore. It was blinding to look upon them. When we had feasted our eyes, we took them all out and made a list of them. There were 143 diamonds of the first water, including one which has been called, I believe, the Great Mogul, and is said to be the second largest stone in existence. Then there were 97 very fine emeralds and 170 rubies, some of which, however, were very small. There were 40 carbuncles, 210 sapphires, 61 agates, and a great quantity of beryls, onyxes, cat's eyes, turquoises, and other stones, the very names of which I did not know at the time, though I have become more familiar with them since. Besides this, there were nearly 300 very fine pearls, 12 of which were set in a gold coronet. By the way, these last had been taken out of the chest and were not there when I recovered it.
We know where those are.
Pearls showed up, huh?
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, that's enough to start a jewelry store right there.
It's a huge collection, right?
Yeah, let's take a few minutes and think about this treasure. Where would you sell these gems? On the underground market? Would you set up a jewelry store? And who walks around with a portfolio of gems? So to me, the gold seems like it'd be a lot easier to sell and probably something a little bit more important. And I also thought about was Indiana Jones, what he would say. He goes, these jewels belong in a museum.
You belong in a museum.
Well, if you have the second largest, whatever it is, many times those are at, I think the Hope Diamonds at the Smithsonian. So many times those types of things go out and they get into museums.
I am not a big fan of collecting rocks, whether they're shiny or not. I don't exactly understand the diamond industry. There was a time where it was much more important than it is now.
Do you know any of the story of how the diamond market came to exist?
Superman took a piece of coal and crushed it in his hands and it became a diamond.
No, it's a total fake market. It's always been a fake market. De Beers created that. Huh. The diamond ring is an engagement ring and how much you spend on it, that's all marketing. That really is, that is the rise of marketing. And these things that are not as rare as we like to think they are, there's as many diamonds as you could ever want. So it really is kind of a, we should read a book on the history of De Beers.
You can do that.
And then all of a sudden you go, yeah, this is not that great of a deal.
Yeah, you can do that. Tell me all about it.
No? No?
I don't understand it. I understand that
it's not real. Like
shiny things, and that's about all I understand about it.
Metals are real. Stones typically are not as real.
Interesting. Pam, are you a big fan of the diamond industry?
No, I don't. I don't do jewelry in any way.
Yeah.
I'm jewel free.
Except around my belly button. I mean, that's the only place I've got a jewel.
Oh, you fay. While in prison, Jonathan Small assisted a surgeon and watched night after night of card playing between Major Sholto and Captain Morriston. Small then approached Sholto with the story of the treasure. He believed that the man's greed would serve his needs. Remember, at this point, Jonathan Small was in prison and he was trying to find his way out, and he thought that this treasure would be his way out. Sholto brought in Morriston on a scheme to get the four, the sign of four. Remember the sign of four? We haven't mentioned that very much in this book. The four people out of prison in exchange for 1/5 of this massive treasure.
Yeah. What we seem to be missing, though, is the reason why they were willing to listen to Jonathan Small. And that's because they were gambling. They weren't really gambling consciously. They weren't gambling to win. They were just gambling to waste some time. So time is being wasted. Gambling is a vice, too. So those are two potential vices. And because of this, they get in debt. And how are they going to go? Because, you know, they said, well, we started out gambling gold coins and stuff. Pretty soon, they're gambling debts. And so these guys now want to get out. And all of a sudden, Jonathan Small saw his opportunity. He had this, I don't know, case of jewels that he could offer. And he wanted to trade his freedom for that. And so these people are willing to help a convict get out of prison, you know, another vice to settle up their debts and become wealthy.
It's an interesting thing that Doyle is giving us here. You know, what is his message here? That gambling is a problem? That the immoral acts of these immoral people are a problem? It's not very clear to me what his message is.
Well, they weren't immoral for their jobs. They had vices. They took some actions that led to some they lost. And because they wanted to settle up and get back in the positive, they were willing to take chances above and beyond what they would consider beforehand moral. I'm not saying gambling's immoral. I'm just saying the results led them to make choices that they would not have made if they were not doing the gambling. Okay. And which kind of brings up what ultimately will come down to our next challenge, or our next topic is loyalty. How that ends up playing and how this group chooses to work together and how loyal they are to each other.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan Small is definitely loyal to the four in the sign of four. And it does not matter where these people came from to him. He is devoted to them and to the treasure, to be honest. Doyle, once again, giving us that long view about class and power, a little bit of racism mixed in there, and national pride of the English and the Indian characters in this story. Jonathan Small says, "Black or blue, said I, they are in with me and we all go together." That's a pretty strong statement from Doyle.
It is, and I think it's really interesting because I kind of get the feeling that Jonathan Small thinks that as he tells these three men his story, Watson, Holmes, and Athelney Jones, that they are going to sort of see his perspective on it, that they are going to realize it was a really crazy time. He was a young guy, like 20 years old. He was a soldier at war, recently recovered from losing his leg, and he was in a really crazy spot, and he did what he could. But that's not exactly how they react. And I think it's interesting, specifically when he tells the story about tripping the little merchant so that the big Sikh could kill him, Watson turns then to show us the men listening. And he says, Jonathan Small stopped and held out his manacled hands for the whiskey and water which Holmes had brewed for him. For myself, I confess that I had now conceived the utmost horror of the man, not only for this cold-blooded business in which he had been concerned, but even more for the somewhat flippant and careless way in which he narrated it. Whatever punishment was in store for him, I felt that he might expect no sympathy from me. Sherlock Holmes and Jones sat with their hands upon their knees, deeply interested in the story, but with the same disgust written upon their faces. He may have observed it, for there was a touch of defiance in his voice and manner as he proceeded. So I think that that's where Doyle is telling us, okay, so Small has this story. He thinks of himself as a guy who has loyalty, who's smart, who's like playing, you know, who's trying to engage in his own self-preservation, etc. But as we watch our British gentlemen, the ones that we hang out with, Watson and Holmes and Athelney Jones, they're not buying any of it, right? Mm. They're disgusted by this guy. And they were open-minded. You did have Holmes saying, tell us about this justice that you think you deserve. Tell us your story. They are not persuaded that the situation of the British Indian War provides any cover for the immoral actions that Small has taken.
And obviously Holmes won't be telling about the boat that's leaving to go overseas to Australia, you know, in a couple hours.
Right. We see that in further stories where Holmes gets to choose the punishment for these things, and he's not willing to do that in this case. I think that you're right, that Holmes and Watson see this guy as guilty and they're ready to put him away. We get back to the frame story. Small is acting as Doyle's voice here and says, well, gentlemen, I weary you with my long story, and I know that my friend Mr. Jones is impatient to get me safely stowed in Chokey, the Cockney word for prison. I'll make it as short as I can. The villain Shoto went off to India, but he never came back again. Captain Morstan showed me his name among a list of passengers in one of the mail boats very shortly afterwards. His uncle had died, leaving him a fortune, and he had left the army. Yet he could stoop to treat five men as he had treated us. Morstan went over to Agra shortly afterwards and found, as we expected, that the treasure was indeed gone. The scoundrel had stolen it all, and without carrying out one of the conditions on which we had sold him the secret. From that day, I lived only for vengeance. This is back to that loyalty.
And I think it reminds us, don't forget, this is only the second story, right? So it's the theme of vengeance that we saw with Jefferson Hope as well. Mm-hmm. So I think there is that notion that when you're a young person, if you get too caught up in a wrong that has been done to you, and in this case, it's like kind of a sketchy to call the wrong had been done to Small, then you will waste your life in, you know, an inefficient and totally non-productive errand of revenge. And so I think in a way we get the same message out of Studying Scarlet and The Sign of Four. Revenge, bad.
And this idea of becoming wealthy very quickly. I mean, he's spent his entire life with this treasure that ultimately he never got to use. It wasn't like he was building wealth. It was like, well, here it is, and now you got to spend all your time trying to get it again to use it.
And I would just say also, just following up on that, Chip, that Jefferson Hope was revenging, you know, the sexual assault on a young woman that he loved. And so, and he is allowed to succeed in his murder. He succeeds in his revenge, and he chooses his own death in a sense. I mean, he's ill and sure. he's not in prison. Whereas Jonathan Small, you know, he doesn't succeed in getting his treasure back. The only sort of revenge is killing Sholto's son, which he didn't even want to do. And he ends up in prison. So back in prison. So those are very different motivations.
Sure. Absolutely.
Doyle pats himself on the back and says he's doing a good job. A very remarkable account, said Sherlock Holmes. A fitting windup to an extremely interesting case. Thanks, Doyle.
I was writing to myself and telling myself what a great job I did. Good job.
And then Watson says, well, and there is the end of our little drama, I remarked, after we had sat some time smoking in silence. I fear that it may be the last investigation in which I shall have the chance of studying your method. Miss Morstan has done me the honor to accept me as a husband in prospective.
Oh.
And so...
Tears. Oh, my God.
So little did he know, about 58 more stories to follow. But and then...
Not to mention all the adaptations.
Right?
Where even Will Ferrell gets a chance.
And then Holmes becomes a little philosophical and, of course, turns to another language. Yes, answered Holmes. There are in me the makings of a very fine loafer and also of a pretty spry sort of fellow. I often think of those lines of old Goethe. I'll just read you the translation, although the book includes the German. Nature, alas, made only one being out of you, although there was material for a good man and a rogue.
Wow, that's very nice. And you weren't shouting at us.
That is very telling, isn't it? That we've talked about this many times. The idea of Sherlock Holmes could have been a master criminal. He chose to be this master detective instead. This is true for all of us. We all have that choice to make. And there's enough material, especially in Chip and I, for two split personalities, that's for sure. Then we get to the ending. Your favorite part, Pam. Your favorite part of the story, the ending. And it's so great.
Stephen King probably learned a lot about endings right here.
Oh, boy. Come on.
Oh, boy.
Okay, so this ending is problematic. I will admit.
What? There's a party at the end. Come on.
So in the ending is the beginning, right?
Mm-hmm.
The division seems rather unfair, I remarked. You have done all the work in this business, Watson says to Holmes. I get a wife out of it. Jones gets the credit. Pray, what remains for you? For me, said Sherlock Holmes, there still remains the cocaine bottle. And he stretched his long white hand up for it.
This is a beautiful romance, a great action story, and it ends with I got cocaine.
he's got a party, Steve. Lots of glitter coming his way.
So, that's terrible.
My initial thought was that Sherlock Holmes would not survive in today's world because not only would he enjoy all this cocaine, his brain would have to go to Las Vegas and high on cocaine and kicked out of most of the casinos for counting cards. And still, he would be convinced he could beat the house. I could do this. Don't make me go away, Watson.
You should really watch CBS Elementary, because Elementary does talk about Sherlock's addiction to drugs and how he's trying really hard to beat his addiction and working on it. And it's hard. It's really, really hard.
Oh, my goodness. So here's a big question for everyone. Did we even need a chapter 12? I mean, couldn't it just stop at 11?
These go to 11.
That's right. The story goes to 11.
It's not a bad question, Chip. Did we need the extra character development on Jonathan Small here? Did we get enough of the character in the previous chapters? I think maybe it would have been okay without this, actually.
If you were writing the movie, would it maybe just end at 11?
It probably would have ended at chapter 11. I agree with that. What do you think, Pam?
Well, I do think we needed to know why the box was empty, right? And, you know, because it's kind of weird that he's just driving around with an empty box.
Okay. Did it change anything to know that the jewels were at the bottom of the Thames?
I mean, I don't think the treasure is gone forever. I mean, there's going to be some diving going on, I would guess. It's not going to go to Mary and Watson. But on the other hand, it was never Major Schultz's in the first place. It was never Miss Major Morstan's. You know what? In some ways, the fact that these jewels are now in the bottom of the Thames to be found by, you know, divers of various kinds in the years to come, that's actually kind of appropriate for these very misbegotten. They're kind of been returned to the earth in a way to be found by whoever finds them.
Street kids. could go diving for them.
The Baker Street Irregulars.
You're absolutely right. You're way smarter than us. You are right. That is the theme. The ill-gotten gains brought you nothing but pain, and you didn't even get to have them at the end. You're right. With the exception of friend Thaddeus, who did get some of the gains.
Those pearls.
But what was Thaddeus's brother's name again, Steve?
I forgot. Was it Brother Bartholomew?
So at this point, you cue the pop song and Brother Bartholomew comes out and sings and does a little dance for us as the credits roll.
This is an animated film all of a sudden.
No. It just keeps going, Steve.
I thought this was Indiana Jones. There's no the bad guy sings and dances at the end of Indiana Jones. All right, so this was a really long chapter with a whole nother action adventure in it, but it worked out really well. I enjoyed chapter 12. I could have done with, you know, maybe split it up into two chapters, but that's okay. That's all right, Doyle. You can rest in peace.
The contract said 12 chapters.
So our contract says that we have an episode coming up tomorrow where we will wrap up the Sign of Four just like Doyle did. And our big question that we've put out there on social media for everybody to answer is, what would you do with $1 million inheritance? Let's forget about the ill-gotten gains part of it for a moment and just say somebody in your family left you $1 million. What would you do? And we've got a lot of great responses, and we're looking forward to having that discussion tomorrow. We want to hear you.
If I had $1 million,
I'd be rich.
We wouldn't have to eat Kraft dinner. We just eat more.
But we would eat Kraft dinner because it's just that good. I love Kraft dinner. I might have that for dinner tonight, actually. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. We'd love to hear the sound of your voice. Send us your pictures. Where's your pictures of Toby and Mary and Watson falling in love and a box of rocks? That would be wonderful. Put the hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes on all of that and follow that discussion around the world. Go to our dedicated website, sandwichesatirregularhours.com, for all of these conversations. Getting close to 100 episodes of Sandwiches at Irregular Hours at this point. Join us tomorrow as we wrap up the Sign of Four. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Patriot Chip Hasselflaw.
And I'm Green Card Holder Pamela Bedore.
Brother Bartholomew!
Wait till Brother Bartholomew has to host tomorrow's episode as we kind of wrap it up, Steve.
I don't know if that's a great idea.